for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
As at every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his OxyContin. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Our quote for the day from Samuel Adams, American patriot. "It does not require a majority to prevail," wrote Sam Adams, "but rather an irate, tireless minority keen to set brush fires in people's minds." Speaking of setting brush fires in people's minds, Russ Feingold wants George Bush held accountable for his crimes. We'll be getting into that in some depth here today in the program. Neelam Sharma is also going to be with us. She's made an impact in communities dominated by urban decay and crime, and will tell us how, ways you might not have thought of. More Downing Street revelations coming out. We are criticizing the United Arab Emirates for their detention policy. We have the State Department has officially criticized them. They say that terrorism suspects can be held for up to 6 months, while at the same time George W. Bush has suspects who have been held in prison for over 3 years without a trial, without charges. An irony alert, let's say, and that and more coming up. But right now, Robert Garmong is with us. He specializes in political theory, ethics, and philosophy of law at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Ayn Rand, of course, the author of Atlas Shrugged and numerous other books that became the philosophical underpinning of what is the objectivist movement. And many people split off from that and became the libertarians, and some people split off from that and became the founders of the Cato Institute and the informed thinkers of the modern-day conservative movement. Although, Robert, I'm sure you wouldn't call yourself a conservative. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here. And no, I wouldn't consider myself to be a conservative, but I do appreciate that Ayn Rand's ideas have been heavily influential on certain members of that movement.
Oh, I think she's had a tremendous impact on this country. Now, that's where you and I part. We both agree she's had a tremendous impact. You would say for the better, I'd say for the worse, but it's been a tremendous impact. So anyhow, you wrote this piece saying that liberals are brainless on the Dubai port and globalization deal. I'm assuming by liberals you're including Congressman Peter King and Bill Frist and those guys?
Yes, I am on this particular one. And to be honest with you, I'm not that concerned about the Republicans who are opposed to the Dubai port deal, because Republicans aren't supposed to be liberals in the classical traditional sense. And by liberal, I mean the philosophical sense.
Liberal meaning responsive to the will of the people, as opposed to conservative meaning responsive to inherited wealth or corporate power, a conservative elite.
Well, I think what we're seeing now is the illiberal left in this particular issue. I think it's especially apparent because the old-fashioned liberal political philosophical tradition said that all men are created equal, that they have inherent inalienable rights that are not grants from society the way that Justice Scalia, for instance, would say they are, but they're grants according to our inherent nature. Nor are they grants from the particular God that you worship, if any. And so it shouldn't matter if you're Muslim or Christian, you should have the same universal human rights. And I think in this case, the reaction of the public was profoundly illiberal, and I think the reaction of many Democrats was profoundly illiberal. And Tom, I don't particularly have an opinion on whether this port deal was a good deal economically or politically. I don't know whether it was the right thing to do. I'm not an expert on that, and it's not my job to be. But what I am worried about is the way people responded to it, because the reaction was immediate, it was knee-jerk, and it was, in my opinion, xenophobic.
Now, well, speaking of xenophobic, I mean, we've had folks on from the Ayn Rand Institute advocating, why don't we just go over and nuke Iran? I mean...
Well, I don't think that's a completely separate issue. I don't think that's the same point, because
Iran didn't send any terrorists to the United States, and two of the guys who hit the World Trade Center were born in the United Arab Emirates, and the money to fund the operation was wired here from the United Arab Emirates. They were one of only three countries to have recognized the existence of the Taliban, which was sheltering and harboring al-Qaeda. So what does that have to do with xenophobia? It seems to me like common sense.
Well, I think the xenophobia comes in the fact that people completely ignored the actual nature of the deal, which was not, we're not selling Manhattan here. We were supposed to rent the operations of certain ports to a company owned over there.
Well, actually,
nothing to do with the security of those ports any more than who owns the grocery store has to do with whether you're protected from robbery there.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that that's an imperfect analogy. First of all, they were buying the port, if you describe the port, as the physical facility. Certainly, they weren't buying the ground underneath it. That's leased from the government.
That's right.
But they're buying the docks. They're buying the machinery. They're buying the warehouses. They're buying the security apparatus. They're hiring the people who are going to be checking the trucks. They're hiring the people who are going to be determining who's there and who's not. How can that not be controlling the area, controlling the security?
Well, first of all, the people doing it, as I understand it, and this is what was publicly acknowledged, is that the people doing the actual operation of the port would still be U.S. unionized stevedores and longshoremen and so on. So there would be no change. It's not as though a bunch of people in Bedouin garb are going to be standing with AK-47s on our port. It's nothing of the kind. It's who has the management of that operation?
You know, Robert, I don't disagree with you that in some regards this is a tempest in a teapot, but I think it raises a larger issue, which probably opens a larger philosophical divide between you and me, and that is that I have a problem with us having a trade policy, you know, rules of trade between us and the rest of the world that has created a $4.5 trillion difference between what we have bought from the world and what we've sold to the world. We owe the rest of the world $4.5 trillion, or more accurately, the rest of the world is sitting on top of, it's actually $4.3 trillion in U.S. dollars, because we've bought all this junk largely from China and all this oil from the Middle East so that we can maintain our lifestyle and so we can have cheap stuff at Walmart. And as a consequence of that, they're looking at us going, okay, we got to spend these dollars in the United States because that's where they're redeemable. And they don't make anything we want anymore, so let's buy their ports, let's buy their buildings, let's buy their publishing companies, let's buy their car companies, let's buy Chrysler, let's buy their, you know, and on and on and on it goes. And I think that a policy, government policy, that brings about that kind of a situation is nuts.
Well, I think I take, once again, we take interestingly opposite points on what might be a point of agreement in a certain sense. I think that given the fact that we do have this international globalized economy, and I think that's a good thing, I think the minute we start to close down America's investments to foreigners, including ownership of ports and so on, I think we very much risk retaliation and we risk the flight of foreign investment dollars. And I think we, in a global economy, we need those things.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you that those globalists among us, you know, Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., to some extent Jimmy Carter, who helped set this thing up, have created a situation now where, you know, we heard in the news this morning, the UAE is moving 10% of their asset reserves out of dollars into euros, and it's causing the dollar to fall on international markets. If they moved 100% of it and they moved it quickly, it could be a disaster for us.
That's right.
But that's, again, the result, in my mind, of failed policies. You say we have a global economy and an international economy. Actually, the number of rules that are used to regulate this economy, the WTO rules, if you were to print them out on single pieces of paper and stack them up in a room, they'd more than fill this studio I'm sitting in, which is probably 15 by 15.
And you know, Tom, I would certainly approve of reduction of regulation of international trade as much as I oppose regulation of internal trade.
But shouldn't a country have the right to protect their own industry and their own workers, Robert Garmon?
Tom, I am a liberal. I believe that every individual has the same rights that you and I have, whether that person is born in Dubai or born in Akron, Ohio.
So you don't then believe that people have the right to organize themselves into a democracy in a country and say, we're going to make decisions that act actually in our best interest, even if that's not going to help the folks in Dubai?
I do not believe that people have the right to violate rights.
So you don't believe that we have the right to form a government and say this government, acting on the will of the people, is going to protect its, for example, steel industry?
I'm not a Democrat. I do not believe in the absolute right of the people to legislate away other people's individual rights.
You're not a small-D Democrat, you mean? In other words, you don't believe in democracy.
That's right. And not in the philosophical sense of democracy.
But democracy is a form of governance, and capitalism isn't. It's a form of, it's an economic system. So what form of governance are you going to have?
I believe in government that the founding fathers called a republic, which is a representative government absolutely limited by individual rights.
But if it is making decisions based on the will of the people, that's democratic.
No, it's a representative system, because there's a profound difference between and a democracy in which there are no limits can do.
Yeah, interesting conversation. Robert Garmong, you can read more about it over at Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Thomas, and great.
16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Felt so good, like anything was possible. Hit cruise control and rub my eyes. The last 3 days, the rain was unstoppable. It was always cold, no sunshine.
And welcome back to Your Light at the End of the Tunnel of Talk Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to our program, my friends. Yes, the conservative worldview in the classical conservative model, the Edmund Burke conservative model, the Sir Edmund Burke, the Russell Kirk conservative model, a Barry Goldwater conservative model, the Bill Frist conservative model, the George Herbert Walker Bush conservative model. George W. Bush doesn't understand politics well enough to have a worldview, frankly, in my opinion. But the conservative model in the minds of all of these folks is leave it to the aristocracy. I mean, that is, after all, the essence of conservative thought. That's the main difference between traditional conservative thought and traditional liberal thought. In the 1700s, the conservatives were the folks who were speaking out in favor of royalty, and the liberals were the folks who were quoting John Locke and Rousseau and saying about the rights of man, what today we would call the rights of people, and saying that people should have the right to govern themselves. And that the reason why we organize ourselves into a government, the reason why we pull ourselves together into a political structure, the reason why we create nations, the reason why we create states, the reason why we create counties, the reason why we create cities, the reason why we create communities, is to decide how we collectively are going to live together, to care for the weakest among us, to protect us from the predators among us, and to make sure that we all have some basic baseline of safety and security in our lives. Conservatives, on the other hand, say, no, you must simply turn that over to corporate power and inherited wealth. After all, they know best. They have earned that right by virtue of the fact that they are the most noble among us. The proof of their nobility? They have all the gold. The old golden rule. Those who have the gold make the rules. This is perhaps most extraordinarily on display in George W. Bush's assertion that even though there is a law, the FISA law, even though there is a law explicitly saying that the president may not wiretap people inside the United States. Now, he can certainly wiretap anybody outside the United States he wants to. No problem. But U.S. citizens, people inside the United States, if he's going to wiretap somebody in the United States, inside the United States, the Supreme Court has ruled that wiretaps are covered under the Fourth Amendment. In other words, your right to have a private conversation on the telephone or by other means, by electronic means, presumably computer, email, and things like that. But that right shall not be abrogated by a government unless that government can demonstrate to a court. In other words, the executive branch, the police power branch of government, shall not have the power to snoop on you and me unless another branch of government, that being the courts, has looked over their shoulder and said, yeah, it looks like this guy might be a bad guy. Not that he is, but it looks like he might be. That's all it takes, is the possibility. And if a court says, yeah, it's possible, sure, listen in. Then the president can do it. And Russ Feingold just nailed this down yesterday and nailed it down absolutely brilliantly. And I know the media is just giving this absolute short shrift. And it was such an important speech that I have a series of clips from it that I want to share with you and just give you a sense of really what this guy was talking about and what was going on. And we will do this through this first hour. And then we've got a lot of just a whole bunch of other stuff to get onto in the 3 hours of our program today. Also, a pile of economic stuff. I mean, the as you know, our conversation with Robert was pointing out, the key issue here, the core for the conservatives, is control of money. You see, they like to quote John Locke, life, liberty, and property. Well, Thomas Jefferson rewrote that in the Declaration of Independence. He wrote life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But back to this censure speech. Here's Russ Feingold.
Mr. President.
When he says Mr. President, by the way, he's speaking to, actually, is the senator from, I believe, South Carolina or North Carolina, who is serving as President pro tem of the Senate, which is officially the vice president's job, but he only does it once a year ceremonially, so he's talking to the President of the Senate, not the President of the United States.
Mr. President, when the President of the United States breaks the law, he must be held accountable. That is why today I'm introducing a resolution to censure President George W. Bush. The president authorized an illegal program to spy on American citizens on American soil and then misled the Congress and the public about the existence and the legality of that program. It is up to this body to reaffirm the rule of law by condemning the president's actions.
Just very straightforward. Russ Feingold, the only senator who anybody is seriously considering for a run for the presidency, who has a really solid voting record on behalf of we the people, standing up, you know, against this so-called corporate free trade and in favor of American interests, standing up for the American people. An extraordinary, extraordinary guy, the senator from Wisconsin, Senator Russell Feingold. And he continues on this topic, and we will get into that. There's just some nuggets from this speech that are not making it into any of the mainstream media. Some things that this guy said on the floor of the Senate yesterday that need to be heard. And need to be heard by Americans. And I will share them with you right after the break at the bottom of the hour here. We will be back with more of Russ Feingold and more here on the Tom Hartman Program, the place where smart people get their news.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Stand up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. Senator Russ Feingold on the floor of the United States Senate yesterday, talking about what we are faced with and how George W. Bush has made use of a climate of uncertainty as a consequence of 9/11. Russ Feingold.
Mr. President, we are faced with an executive branch that places itself above the law. The founders understood that the branches must check each other to control abuses of government power. The president's actions are such an abuse. His actions must be checked, and he should be censured. This president exploited the climate of anxiety after September 11, 2001, both to push for overly intrusive powers in the Patriot Act and to take us into a war in Iraq that has been a tragic diversion from the critical fight against Al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
He just lays it right out. And then he goes on to, and this is the part that the mainstream media will not touch, and I think it's all the more the tragedy. He goes on to just lay out the specific lies of George W. Bush. He, you know, being a senator, he doesn't call them lies, but he just lays them right out, just lays this stuff out bare. This is so important for Americans to be hearing this speech from Russ Feingold yesterday.
Now, the facts are pretty straightforward. Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, nearly 30 years ago to ensure that as we wiretap suspected terrorists and spies, we also protect innocent Americans from unjustified government intrusion. Mr. President, FISA makes it a crime to wiretap Americans on U.S. soil without the requisite warrants, and the president has ordered warrantless wiretaps of Americans on U.S. soil. So it's pretty simple. The president has broken that law. And that alone is unacceptable. But the president did much more than that. Not only did the president break the law, he also actively misled Congress and the American people about his actions. And then, when the program was made public about the legality of the NSA program, he has fundamentally violated the trust of the American people. The president's own words show just how seriously he has violated that trust.
And this is where Feingold gets into just quoting the president, showing that this guy not only lied to us, but knew he was lying to us. This is what Feingold calls the violation of the trust.
We now know that the NSA wiretapping program began not long after September 11th. Before the existence of this program was revealed, the president went out of his way. He went out of his way, Mr. President, in several speeches to assure the public that the government was getting court orders to wiretap Americans in the United States, something he now admits was not the case. On April 20, 2004, for example, the president told an audience in Buffalo that, quote, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretaps, it requires a wiretap, requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way, unquote. In fact, a lot had changed. But the president wasn't up front with the American people. Just months later, on July 14, 2004, in my own state of Wisconsin, the president said that, quote, any action that takes place by law enforcement requires a court order. In other words, the government can't move on wiretaps or roving wiretaps without getting a court order, unquote. And then, Mr. President, last summer, on June 9, 2005, the president spoke in Columbus, Ohio, and again insisted that his administration was abiding by the laws governing wiretaps. Quote, law enforcement officers need a federal judge's permission to wiretap a foreign terrorist phone, a federal judge's permission to track his calls, or a federal judge's permission to search his property. Officers must meet strict standards to use any of these tools, and these standards are fully consistent with the Constitution of the United States, unquote. Now, Mr. President, in all of these cases, the president knew that he wasn't telling the complete story.
Now, did you hear on any news anywhere, on the talking head shows, anywhere, anybody discussing the fact that Feingold laid out three specific times that the president of the United States lied to the American people and about breaking the law? In fact, Feingold goes on to say this is really troubling stuff.
But engaged in tough political battle during the presidential campaign and later over the Patriot Act reauthorization, he wanted to convince the public that a system of checks and balances was in place to protect the innocent people from government snooping. He knew when he gave those reassurances that he had authorized the NSA to bypass the very system of checks and balances that he was using as a shield against criticism of the Patriot Act and his administration's performance. Mr. President, this conduct is unacceptable. The president has a duty to play it straight with the American people. But for political purposes, he just ignored that duty. After a New York Times story exposed the NSA program in December of last year, the White House launched an intensive effort to mislead the American people yet again. No one would come to testify before Congress until February, but the president's surrogates held press conferences and made speeches to try to somehow convince the public that they had actually acted lawfully. Most troubling of all, the president himself participated in this disinformation campaign.
You get this, a United States senator saying the president himself participated in a disinformation campaign? This is groundbreaking. This is huge. This is an incredible story. It was not reported in the media. Back to Russ Feingold.
In the State of the Union address, he implied that the program was necessary because otherwise the government would be unable to wiretap terrorists at all. Now, Mr. President, that is simply untrue. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. You don't need a warrant to wiretap terrorists overseas, period. That's clear. You do need a warrant to wiretap Americans on American soil, and Congress passed FISA specifically to lay out the rules for these types of domestic wiretaps.
Which George W. Bush chose to ignore. And now he's got all his sycophants running around in the media as well, saying, we don't need those laws. Feingold continued in his speech yesterday.
The president's claims of inherent executive authority and his assertions that the courts have approved this type of activity are baseless. But it is one thing to make a legal argument that has no real support in the law. It is much worse to do what the president has done, which is to make misleading statements about what prior presidents have done and what courts have approved to try to somehow make the public believe that his legal arguments are much stronger than they really are. For example, in the State of the Union, the president argued that federal courts have approved the use of presidential authority that he was invoking. I asked the Attorney General about this when he came before the Judiciary Committee, and Mr. President, he could point me to no court, not the Supreme Court or any other court, that has considered whether, after FISA was enacted, the president nonetheless had the authority to bypass it and authorize warrantless wiretaps. Not one court.
This is, you know, just very straightforward. The Bush comes out and in his State of the Union address says, I have the authority. So Feingold gets Gonzalez in front of him and says, what court gave him the authority? Because Bush in his State of the Union said, courts have said that I have the authority. Not one. It was a lie. In the State of the Union address, it was a lie. Feingold continues.
The administration's effort to find support for what it has done in snippets of other court decisions would be laughable if this issue were not so serious. In the same speech, the president referred to other presidents in American history who cited executive authority to order warrantless surveillance. But of course, Mr. President, those past presidents, like Wilson and Roosevelt, were acting long before the Supreme Court decided in 1967 that our communications are protected by the Fourth Amendment, and before Congress decided in 1978 that the executive branch could no longer unilaterally decide which Americans to wiretap. So I asked the Attorney General about this issue when he testified before the Judiciary Committee. And neither he nor anyone else in the administration has been able to come up with a single prior example of wiretapping inside the United States since 1978 that was conducted outside of FISA's authorization. So again, the president's arguments in the State of the Union were baseless. And it is unacceptable that the president of the United States would so obviously mislead the Congress and the American public.
Period. End of discussion. Feingold adds,
this president hides behind flawed legal arguments and even behind the office he holds. But he cannot hide from what he has created. Nothing short of a constitutional crisis.
This is a constitutional crisis. After I heard that, I watched the entire speech on C-SPAN. I was amazed. I kept flipping back over to CNN thinking, they've got to be covering this. Nope, they weren't covering it. Arlen Specter interrupted him in the middle of the speech. Arlen Specter followed up and actually, you know, agreed with some of what Feingold was saying, much, I'm sure, to the discomfort of the Republicans on the floor. Although he wasn't politically, he couldn't go there. And I immediately, after watching this, I said, you know, even a Republican has to agree with it. I picked up the phone and I called my two senators. I called Gordon Smith's office, senator from Oregon, the Republican, and I just got an answering machine, which is what usually happens when I call Senator Smith's office. And so I left a message. You know, here's who I am. Here's where I live. Here's my phone number. This is my name. And please support Senator Feingold's censure resolution. And then I called Senator Wyden's office and left the same message. I had Senator Wyden on my radio program this morning, my local program on KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, and asked him if he was going to support it. And he pointed out that Feingold has not yet called for a vote on the thing. So he's, you know, why put your neck on the chopping block if the axe isn't there yet, right? But I have a feeling that when this comes around, it's going to be very, very interesting politically. The conventional wisdom, everybody's running from it. I think they should be running to it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and don't.
And welcome back, my friends. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour. It was one of my screaming at the TV moments. I had just watched Russ Feingold on C-SPAN, and he was saying that this is one of the ways he wrapped up his speech.
The president's wrongdoing demands a response, and not just a response that prevents wrongdoing in the future, but a response that passes judgment on what has already happened. We in the Congress bear the responsibility to check a president who has violated the law, who continues to violate the law, and who has not been held accountable for his actions.
Talk about the little boy who said the emperor had no clothes. I mean, he was a United States senator. This president violated the law, and we need to hold him responsible. And this was my screaming at the TV moment. I flip over to CNN, and Wolf Blitzer is interviewing Ed Henry, who I'm increasingly thinking of as that weasel. And Ed Henry, there, I don't know if he's, what is he? He's not the White House correspondent. He's some sort of political correspondent. And Ed Henry's going, well, it looks like maybe the Republicans are going to do the same thing with Feingold's resolution that they did with Murtha's resolution. You know, he says, Murtha wanted to pull out of Iraq, and so the Republicans put his resolution up for a vote, and everybody voted against it. And so maybe they're going to do the same thing in the Senate. And I'm going, Ed, you're lying. You're quoting Republican talking points. That's not what happened. What happened was Jack Murtha said that we need to redeploy. We need to pull back. He was not asking for a resolution, a specific resolution or a piece of legislation. He was he certainly would have been happy with one. He didn't have a specific proposal put forward. And immediately the Republicans threw up a piece of legislation that was sponsored by a Republican, which said that within 24 hours, the American forces shall pull out of Iraq. And everybody, including Murtha, voted against it because it was nuts. And then they went on all the talking head shows and said, oh, look at the Congress doesn't support Murtha. I mean, the audacity of the Republican lies. And then Ed Henry on CNN yesterday repeating it and saying, well, maybe they're going to do the same thing with Feingold. It's enough to make you crazy. I have a friend who is a professor in a major university in the United States, and I'm sure would not want to be identified, so I'm not going to say more than that. But is somebody I've known for some time and somebody who I believe, who was a fraternity brother of George W. Bush's at Yale and in his undergrad years. And a bunch of them went out one night, and including Bush, and they went into a poorer part of town and trashed a guy's car and trashed an area. I don't recall all the details, but they got caught, and they had to show up in court. And my friend said that he and all of his fraternity brothers showed up in court, or the ones who were involved in this thing, and they showed up in court, you know, a week later, wearing their dress clothes, you know, suit and tie and the whole bit, ready to, you know, plead guilty and accept, you know, whatever it is. And the court had to wait because they were waiting for George W. Bush. He was, you know, one of the group. And finally, Bush comes in wearing jeans and penny loafers with no socks and a shirt, you know, open collar shirt, and just walks right up the middle of the aisle, right up to the judge, like he owns the courtroom, and pulls out a checkbook and says, "How much do I owe you?" And the judge says, "Well, we've got a process here. We've got to go through a procedure. There are witnesses." And Bush says, "I don't care about your process. Just tell me how much to write the damn check for. I got to get out of here." And the judge was startled and conferred with one of the lawyers and finally said, you know, $300 or whatever it was. And Bush writes the check and throws it at him and turns around and walks out. This is a person who has never lived by the rules and doesn't intend to now. And Feingold comes forward and says, we want to hold him to the rules. And I'm just boggled by this. It's that this can go on. Just boggled by it. Kelly in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Kelly, thanks for calling.
Hey, no problem. Hey, I just wanted to make a couple of points. First of all, I'm enjoying you here on actually, I guess that would be 3 points. Sirius Satellite Radio.
Oh, great.
Glad to take you up here while I'm enjoying the wonders of a state park in Arizona. And it would seem if, you know, Bush has, in fact, violated the Constitution of the United States, that I, as a citizen of this country, should have standing to bring a suit against him. And apparently it doesn't work that way, although I do understand that there are a couple of groups who are now trying to pursue legal action against Bush and his administration for this illegal wiretapping. And
so far as I know, there is this thing of sovereign immunity. There is you can't sue the government unless the government gives you permission to sue it, and you can't sue a government official for doing their you know, what they perceive to be their job, even if they do it badly without the permission of the government to do it. And but there is a mechanism for removing officers and officials, judges, presidents, senators, whatever, who are committing crimes, and that procedure is called impeachment.
Right. But there are really a couple of groups bringing lawsuits against either Bush himself or the administration because they have reason to believe that they may have been part of this.
That's right. Specific crimes have been committed against them. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And back in the late 60s, early 70s, some of us who were spied upon by various government agencies did the same thing against state police departments and against the FBI and got, you know, mind-boggling quantities of documentation about, you know, everything that they were looking at about our lives. But, yeah, yeah.
Right.
So,
if I do it myself, hopefully these groups will have success and do it for us.
Yeah,
on behalf
well
of
said.
The people.
Well said, Kelly. Thank you very much for the call. Paula in Eureka. Hey, Paula, we just have a few seconds left. Quick comment?
Hi, Tom. I called Senator Frist's office this morning, and I just let him know that I really found his remarks where he said he was speaking for us, for the commander-in-chief. I said, you don't speak for me, and I resent that, and I support my Constitution and the checks and balances contained therein. So
good
anyone
on you,
else should try to call, too, and let him know that.
Yeah, and not just Frist. Call your two senators.
I did that, too. Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Good on you. Thank you, Paul.
Bye.
Yeah, the toll-free number for Congress, if you want to call your member of your senator, just call and ask. If you're not sure who your senators are, just tell them what your state is. They'll tell you. Toll-free number, 888-355-3588. 888-355-3588. I support Russ Feingold's censure resolution, and you should, too. Because you are answerable to me. I am a taxpayer and a voter. We the people. Don't get too snotty, because you're dealing with some staffer who's got a tough job anyway, you know. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
This is absolutely incredible. All the lefties out there, as some folks might say, the looking at the opinionator, right? This is the blog over at the New York Times. Opinionator.blogs.nytimes.com. And now that Josh Marshall has endorsed the liberal backlash against the liberal case for impeachment, Josh Marshall saying it's a bad idea on policy grounds, bad idea on political grounds, lefties are beginning to make the liberal case against Russ Feingold's censure resolution, which the senator from Wisconsin unveiled. By the way, the last time that the Senate rolled out a censure resolution, which didn't pass, did not pass, by the way, was when the Republicans in the Senate, who did not have a majority in the Senate at the time, when the Republicans in the Senate tried to censure Bill Clinton. After they tried to convict him of his impeachment and failed, they then tried to censure him and failed. But, you know, it was a good effort, and look at what it got them. It got them the presidency. It got them political power. Where is this idea coming from that says if you stand up for what you believe in, if you speak the truth, if you stake out a position and say, this is where we stand, there is a clear law here that says that the president cannot do this. Bush is doing it. Bush is lying to us about his doing it. He lied to us for several years about his doing it. He's now lied to us about his lies. His enablers are out there lying. I don't get it. I mean, this seems to me the worst kind of Bob Schrum politics, of the inside the beltway talking heads. We're Democrats. We can't stand up for anybody. We can't do that. At The Notion, a group blog for The Nation magazine contributing editor Mark Cooper says he feels, quote, great ambivalence, end quote, over Feingold's measure. The most important question, he says, for Democrats is whether pushing for censure is smart politics. He says censure or impeachment is neither about the law nor really very much about the Constitution. They are instead strictly and wholly political acts. Nonsense! It is about the law. It's about his having broken the law. And it's all about the Constitution because it's about his having violated the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. But Cooper over at The Nation magazine says, so we have to ask ourselves, is Feingold's move actually good politics? And Cooper says, no, it isn't. He says, there must be a political consensus to move ahead with such acts. Either untenable revulsion, either by even by one's own party, as was the case with Nixon, who jumped before getting pushed, or of a solid bipartisan opposition majority, as was the case with Bill Clinton. I'm sorry, they didn't have a solid partisan majority. Well, actually, perhaps the majority of the Republicans were on board with that. Okay. He says, neither of these conditions is present in the case of George W. Bush. Well, more so the tragedy. So far, Joe Lieberman has come out in opposition to this. Joe Lieberman. And he's the guy that they're doing the stories on. Oh, gee, Joe, what do you think of this? What do Democrats think about this? Oh, well, I don't think it's a good idea. And Harry Reid has said, well, let's postpone the vote on this thing. Because Bill Frist said, okay, we'll have a vote right now. And Reid says, no, what we need to do is we need to have some hearings. And Reid is right. You don't just pass a resolution to censure the President of the United States without a hearing. You want the American people to have an opportunity to see and hear the United States Senate calling witnesses under threat of subpoena to stand before them and speak the truth about what this guy has done. Did George W. Bush illegally wiretap Americans? And if so, what should the penalty be? How should he be held accountable? And Frist says, oh, we'll have a vote. No, no, I'm sorry, Harry Reid says. We need to have hearings. This needs to be discussed. He's right. The New York Times is spinning it right now as, oh, Harry Reid's trying to back off from this. No, I don't think so. When I talked to Ron Wyden this morning, it didn't sound to me like he was backing off from it either. It sounded to me like he was saying, we need to have hearings. This is serious stuff. And the Republicans will not allow hearings. And John McIntyre over at Real Clear Politics, another so-called liberal blog. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. I haven't read it. Anyhow, he says the censure resolution is good for both Feingold's presidential prospects and the Republican Senate majority. That's an interesting one. He notes if Feingold hopes to seriously get in the mix in the 2008 field, he's going to have to be a pure insurgent candidate, a la 08 Howard Dean, and this move only helps in that regard. Republicans, on the other hand, should use the opportunity that Feingold has provided them and hammer Democrats mercilessly on this issue. If played right, this could be like the Jack Murtha episode, where Democrats will have to turn their nonstop Bush bashing and vote against Feingold, or risk appearing to be on the Michael Moore fringe of the debate. Ah, this must be a right-wing blog. Because Murtha's suggestions never got voted on. Instead, the Republicans created a caricature of what Murtha was saying. They created a straw man, and they voted on the straw man. Well, of course, this is over at the New York Times blog. Why am I surprised? It's the liberal media, don't you know? No, I'm sorry, it's not. Where was the liberal media when we were ginning up a phony war on phony circumstances? You know, doing what is absolutely illegal in violation of the United Nations resolutions. And yes, we clearly violated Resolution 1441. We clearly violated the laws of the United States of America. We, George W. Bush. And this is so beyond the pale. What this guy has done as president, and it's time for him to be held accountable for it. I went over to russfeingold.org. I went over to his website, and I made a small contribution yesterday. I was like, you know, I want this guy to know. I want him to know that I think this is great behavior. I want to encourage more of it. Now, you know, I couldn't send much, but it was enough to register, hey, I'm here with you. And you can do that at russfeingold.org, by the way, just as an FYI. 1-866-440-8466. We got a lot of other stuff to talk about here, but just to wrap this up, Andra in Seattle, Washington. Or is it Andra? in Seattle. Hello. Oh, Andra, if you must be listening to your radio instead of your telephone. Let's try Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan.
Hey, what's up? I just wanted to say this DLC strategy really doesn't make sense, especially when Republicans do more and more audacious things, because the middle of the road point of view starts moving more and more to the right, because they keep going more and more to the right, the Republicans.
Yeah, to quote or to paraphrase, I don't know if it was Jim Hightower or if it was some other Democratic consultant, but the only thing you find in the middle of the road are yellow lines and dead raccoons, you know.
Well, I mean, it made sense if you had a normal Republican Party to be in the middle of the road, but now it's like a completely neo-fascist party. So if you go in the middle road between us and them, you end up kind of semi-fascist yourself.
Yeah, it was dead armadillos. But the middle of the road here really is we the people. It's you know, the people of the United States of America.
The true middle. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And what all these guys, you know, from the New York Times on, what they're all referring to as liberal is the middle of the road. And that is, hey, let's follow the Constitution. Let's have a balanced budget. Let's have a health care system that works. Let's have Social Security that's safe and secure. Let's have protection for working people in the United States. Let's have, you know, food safety standards. Let's not sell off our country. I mean, this isn't just the middle of the road. This is common sense. Logan, thanks a lot. Go ahead.
They found a way. Hello?
Yeah.
They found a way to game the system, these Republicans. It seems to me that the founding fathers did not anticipate this kind of tactic.
Oh yeah, they absolutely anticipated it, and that's why they wrote impeachment and censure is not in the Constitution, it's in the Senate rules. That's why they wrote it in there.
Majority.
Say it again.
He'd have a majority though to have an impeachment, and these guys have controlled the majority. So there's no. I mean, I just feel like there's a flaw there.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, the ultimate checks and balance, the ultimate check and balance, Logan, that the founders and the framers of the Constitution wrote into it to protect against this kind of thing is called elections. We have them every 2 years. Every single member of the House of Representatives is reelected every 2 years. And that is the referendum of, by, and for we the people. And that's the one that we have to have our eye on. This is what we have to be focusing on. This is what we have to be attending to very carefully. This is what we have to be working on, because there's an election coming up, and it's going to be in a blink of an eye. An absolute blink of the eye. And primaries are happening right now all across the United States. And that's got to be where we stand up and speak out. And yeah, I know there's voting machines and all that, and you know, people get all upset about that. And you know, we have to do everything we can, with or without rigged voting machines, to make it an overwhelming landslide, so that we can then take care of things like, gee, why is it the Republicans don't want to control the voting machines? Is it just because their cronies make a lot of money off it, or is there something more to it? But nonetheless, we can't do that if we don't get active. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Radio.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Note I just got, those bastards in Congress are going to go down in history as the Congress that didn't support Abraham Lincoln. I wish we could organize an internet vote and a paper vote to some kind of confabulation to see how many people supported Feingold. Well, I think if enough people, I mean, it's just like Howard Dean. The way that everybody understood that Howard Dean, that there was this huge groundswell of support in the United States for Howard Dean, was that everybody went to his site and gave him $25. And, I mean, you know, you get a million people giving you $25, you got $25 million. That's nothing to sneeze about. We'll be back with your phone calls and more in just a few minutes. First, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is with us. Hey, Victoria, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today is there are various hearings going on Capitol Hill. Not the one I was looking forward to, which was John Bolton, who was going to be testifying about the future of the U.N., which is always fun because you never know when he's going to completely lose it.
yes, he's definitely got a screw loose.
You just show up to those hearings just in case, you know. But anyway, that's been postponed, although Alberto Gonzalez is testifying this afternoon to justify his budget before the House Appropriations Committee. That's certainly going to be lively.
Now, give me a political take on this.
I'll try.
Did you hear or see or read the transcript of Russ Feingold's entire speech yesterday?
Not the entire speech, I have to say. No, I didn't.
Okay. Please let me recommend it. It is brilliant. There are very few unnecessary words. He goes through three specific times that George W. Bush lied to the American people knowingly and intentionally about breaking the law.
Well, I understand it.
Yeah, and then talked about how Bush has changed his tune and now saying that he never needed to follow that law, even though before he was saying that he was following the law, and saying, you know, we just have to hold this guy accountable. And the New York Times, Frist says, okay, let's hold a vote on this, essentially. And you don't hold a vote on something like this without holding hearings. You want to have an investigation. And the New York Times is portraying Harry Reid's call for hearings as Democrats backpedaling. I don't take it as Democrats backpedaling. I take it as Democrats saying we want to hold the president accountable. Who's right here?
Well, I think politically at the moment the Republicans have managed to frame this the way they wanted to, and Feingold politically has played into their hands. And I witnessed it again today when I was at two press conferences with senators just now, in which all Democratic senators, in which they were asked, are you going to vote for his, for his censure motion? Are you going to support it? In other words, putting them on the record, and they don't want to go on the record. So,
right.
I think the political perception is that Democrats are on the run. I think the reality is rather different. And if the Democrats are smart, but, you know, Tom, I'm just not sure that they are politically, if they're smart, they will reframe this, they want it framed, rather than just saying, well, of course we want hearings. Make that the point that we just won this issue. We're getting hearings.
Right.
Make it something that
they haven't gotten the hearings yet. I mean, Frist has not said that he will allow there to be hearings to be held on this. I'm quite sure he won't.
Well, it's gone to the Judiciary Committee. I mean, so the hope is that there will be hearings. But what they can do is to make it sound like this is at least a preliminary victory.
So this is now in Arlen Specter's hands. He's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
Arlen Specter and Pat Leahy is the number two guy. So people should be contacting Arlen Specter and Pat Leahy and saying, we want hearings on Feingold's resolution.
If indeed that's, I get very confused by Senate procedure, but at this point, as it's been referred to them, I would assume that that's where it is, unless Frist does get to have another nay say. I know that he would like to force a vote on this. That's what he would like to have happen.
Yeah.
And I know, and it's clear that the White House would like the same thing. Scott McClellan yesterday in the press briefing was almost gleeful in saying that he looks forward to finding out which Democratic senators are on the record with this.
Yeah, interesting.
And by the way, Senator Schumer just now, when he was specifically asked, said that he had no comment. He was not going to comment until, you know, he found out all the facts and all this, that, and the other. And
these guys, they all want to stick their finger in the up and, you know, lick their finger and stick it up in the wind and see which way it's blown.
They're all doing that. And Senators Landrieu and Stabenow also did that earlier on.
Yeah, and I talked to Ron Wyden this morning. But Ron Wyden actually...
He's usually gutsy.
He was, actually. I interviewed him on our local program, and he said... That there need to be hearings immediately into whether or not the president broke the law. I mean, he was unambiguous about it. I said, well, are you going to support Feingold's resolution? And he said, well, Feingold has not yet asked for there to be a vote. So Feingold is not asking people to say whether or not they support it. Feingold is asking for there to be hearings. And he said, and I support the hearings.
You see, unfortunately, what Feingold's done by introducing the censure, even though what he wants and what he says he wants is hearings, it has been framed by the Republicans as, you know, if you introduce a censure motion, this is how most Americans, I think, understand this now, if you introduce a censure motion, that means you want everyone to vote on the censure.
Yeah.
And if, in fact, it doesn't mean that, then that has to be made clear. In other words, I think the Democrats in running from this or being perceived to run from this have not done themselves a service.
Oh, I agree.
You
and
know?
I'm just curious to what extent are they perceived to be running from it versus being the media saying that they're running from it.
I think the perception is that they are running from it.
Yeah, well, that's a tragedy.
It is.
And if there is an absolute groundswell of support for Russ Feingold, you know, a million people or hundreds of thousands of people going to his website and tossing $25 at him or whatever, a groundswell of support and people calling their senators, maybe the rest of the Democrats will say, oh, that's the way the wind is blowing.
I think a lot of people think he was gutsy to do it.
Yeah, and me too. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group of By and For We the People of the United States of America. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We're going to do a progressive pop quiz here. We'll take some calls while the folks in New York are answering the phones and figuring out who's winning the contest. But the 10th caller to call 1-866-440-8466 and correctly answer the following question will win a copy of Ultimate Sacrifice, a book that Lamar Waldron and I wrote, the subtitle John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of JFK. 866-440-8466. And the question is, which nation has offered free health care to all persons older than 60, effective today? 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with that in just a few minutes. Jeff in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to talk about Feingold and why the news is not covering what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I think that the news media just don't want to be caught in a lie later on. Because
What's the lie?
What Feingold is saying.
What did Feingold say that's a lie, in your opinion, Jeff?
Well, you see, I think that there's a lot of uncredible stuff being thrown around by the new lips on this subject, and one of them
by the what?
Well, you guys call us neocons, so I'm calling you new libs.
Oh, I see. Okay. New neoliberals. Okay, all right.
Okay, but you see, the thing about wiretapping, you know, I believe that the president was talking about wiretapping as a landline type of deal where you have to put instruments on the landline to tap it, and that is illegal. But info mining has been in existence for long, long time, and you just pick up things off the air and you listen to it. And the fact that the president asked...
We're talking here, Jeff, specifically about wiretapping. In fact, here's George W. Bush talking about this.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap,
yes,
it requires a wiretap requires a court order.
Now, he was lying when he said this.
Nothing has changed.
Well, actually, he's telling the truth about that.
When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so.
You get that? George W. Bush saying, we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order. And he knew that for 2 years he had been chasing down terrorists without a court order. So he was lying. He was lying to you. He was lying to me.
Landlines. That's landlines that are, need to have something put on it. You know, info.
You don't
need that. You just pick it off the air. And they've been doing that. And to be specifically, I mean,
Jeff, you just heard George W. Bush say, when you're going to wiretap, you have to have a warrant. That's true. That's what the law says.
He's not wiretapping. He's just thinking, I mean,
we're talking about wiretapping here. You can talk about data mining all you want, but we're talking about wiretapping. It's a whole completely different thing.
But the technology that the terrorists are using is these cellular phones. They get thousands of those, and they just keep changing it. And so the technology for listening to them has changed. Not from wiretaps on landlines, but listening in on all these
cases. I agree with you, Jeff, and the FISA court is there to deal with that. Our laws have changed. Our systems have changed. That doesn't mean that you give the President of the United States unlimited power. You never, ever want to give the President unlimited power.
But he's not lying in this case. He's trying to mince his words, but at the same time, he's not lying. He is.
He has wiretapped people inside the United States without warrants. Do you acknowledge that, Jeff?
No, I don't, because listening in, I don't believe that he has hardwire anybody's line against the law.
Okay, well, then in that case, then let's listen to George W. Bush and what he had to say after he got caught.
There's a process that goes on inside the Justice Department, and I presume about leaks. I presume that process is moving forward. My personal opinion is it was a shameful act
to out him
for someone to disclose this very important program in time of war.
Yeah, this very illegal program.
But he's still talking about
the fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy. You got to understand, and I hope the American people understand, there is still an enemy that would like to strike the United States of America, and they're very dangerous.
And then Bush continues by saying,
but it is a shameful act by somebody who has got secrets of the United States government and feels like they need to disclose them publicly.
Yeah, and the secret being that Bush illegally broke the law, and then he goes on to say he doesn't need
quick
a warrant.
To detect and prevent. We use FISA still.
See, here he is. We still use FISA.
Of course we use FISA. But FISA's is for long-term monitoring. What is needed in order to protect the American people is the ability to move quickly to detect.
Yeah, and he's monitoring.
See, that's a falsehood, because you can move quickly to detect right now. You can easily move quickly to detect. All you have to do is go to the FISA court.
And the FISA court is set up to.
And you can do it up to 3 days after the fact. Jeff, right. I'm sorry, you're just wrong. By the way, our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. The 10th caller to tell us which country, effective today, has offered, which is a South American country, here's a clue for you, has said that all members of that country older than 60 years old immediately get free public health care. Wins a copy of Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, and the Plan for a Coup in Cuba. Andra in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Andra, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good morning, Tom. Thank you for being so positive all the time when I start to get depressed. You make my day.
Well, I'm an optimist, I guess.
Yes, you are. Well, hey, listen, I have a plan, and I think it will get media attention to Feingold and his resolution. And what I think we need to do is have as many people as possible send actual thank you notes to his Green Bay, Wisconsin office. We can't do it to D.C. because, you know, it takes 2 months to screen them.
Right.
But actual physical thank you cards rather than just emails and phone calls, maybe throw in $5 and
right.
thank you cards for what he's done. I've already started it on the blogs, and if we can get as many blogs as possible to sponsor this, and let's say he gets swamped with 10,000 thank you cards within the next couple of days, that should get media attention.
Yeah, and his postal address is apparently P.O. Box 620062, Middleton, Wisconsin, 53562. And if anybody didn't get that, you can just go to russfeingold.org, and it's right there.
Yeah, I've got the Green Bay, Wisconsin office.
Oh, okay, you've got a different one, yeah. Apparently that's his finance, the Senate committee.
But I think if as many people as possible sponsor this on the blogs and we can get 10,000 thank you cards to show up there in the next couple of days, that'll get mainstream media to say they're serious.
Yeah. Okay. Well said. Andrew,
okay.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
good to,
Tom.
Good to hear from you. Shannon in Brainerd, Minnesota, is it, Shannon?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Shannon, how you doing today?
Oh, just dandy. I'd like to tell you I just got in touch with both of my senators, Norman Storm and Norman Coleman, the puppet of the golden boy of George W., and told him that I insisted that he support Feingold, which I know he won't, but hey,
yeah,
you know, he needs to hear it. And Mark Dayton, who's kind of a lame duck right now, he's not running for re-election, and his seat is up, I think, this year. And, well, since he doesn't have anything to lose, I figure there's a pretty good bet that he might actually do it.
What's in Minnesota? I'm curious. What, because frankly, I was surprised. Well, what Democrat is going to run in for Dayton's seat? Is there a Democratic primary going?
I don't even know. I haven't even been paying that much attention to it, which is, you know, my bad. Of course,
That's life. You know, you're entitled to be busy.
Been looking for that elusive job market that George Bush keeps flogging.
Well, you know, that's part of the whole strategy. I mean, it's amazing. For example, here in Portland, Oregon, right now, there is they're short on funding for the schools, which I know is a problem all across the United States.
Yeah.
All across the United States.
I told whoever was answering the phone for Senator Dayton, as a veteran of the global war on terror. I got the little ribbon that says I was a veteran of the global war on terror, whatever that means. Told him that I want that filthy traitor that's sitting in the Oval Office to be held accountable. Finally, you know, after how many years of him spitting on the Constitution, I tell you, it's so hard not to swear, Tom, and it's so hard.
Well, I appreciate you're not forcing us to use our dump button here.
Yeah, after so many years of him spitting on the Constitution, when can we finally hold this guy accountable?
Yeah, yeah.
I got to take my
the when, Shannon, to your answer, by the way, the when we can hold him accountable is the first week of November of this year.
Let's hope so.
And that's the bottom line, and it's going to be the consequence of our getting involved. And thank you for calling your senators.
Yeah.
Good on you, Shannon.
Good work.
Yeah, good to hear from you. Thank you very much. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. We have a winner in our contest. We're gathering the information. I'll share it with you in just a moment. And Senator Feingold's website, of course, russfeingold.org, if you want to check that out. And if you want to call your senator, the toll-free number, 888-355-3588. 888-355-3588. And we'll be back after the break with the winner to the contest. I'll just tell you the answer here, since we already have a winner. The newly inaugurated President Michelle Bachelet said Monday that all Chileans older than 60 will immediately begin receiving free care at public hospitals. She says this will become effective immediately today or tomorrow. She's also a physician. She was also tortured by the Pinochet regime. She was so this is a marvelous thing, although she will now be labeled a socialist in the media in the United States, and pretty soon you can expect to hear the President of the United States railing against her because how dare she offer free health care even to people over 60, even on a limited basis. We can't have that. It's not the capitalist way. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
They love Dubia and hate the French. It don't really have to make sense. Fox News is a tabloid. Disinformation from a mindless boy. A great American crapazoid. Fox News is a tabloid.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. Well, we have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. It's Jim in Seattle. Hey, Jim, congratulations. There you go. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And, Jim, how did you know that it was Chile?
Thanks to Google.
My first instinct is to say, oh, wait a minute, that's cheating. You're supposed to read the paper. But wait a minute, Google it. This is great. This is actually you're a smart guy.
Well, I found it was in the San Diego Times, so
yeah.
I don't get that delivered to my doorstep.
Yeah. This is, by the way, 1.7 million of Chile's 16 million people are older than 60 and thus instantly covered for all medical expenses under Michelle Bachelet's new program, which she introduced the day that she was inaugurated as the first woman president of any South American country who was not the former wife of a previous male president. So the first woman in South and Central America to actually be elected on her own merits. And good on her and good on you, Jim. And you've already given Dan Jacobs there in New York, you've given him the information so we can send you the book?
Yes.
You're all set on that. Okay, great. Jim, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
And congratulations on winning the contest. Great to hear from you. John in Greensboro, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about, of course I am in favor of Russ Feingold standing up to attempt to get some spine in the rest of the Senate Democrats to actually hold President Bush accountable for admittedly breaking the law.
Right.
I want to comment, though, a couple of calls ago, a caller named Jeff.
Right.
Jeff seems to be symptomatic of almost something that I consider nearly a mental illness on the part of some Bush supporters. where the president is caught making a false statement, and there's essentially no other logical explanation but that it's a lie. In other words, not all false statements are lies, because we all say things that are, you know, untrue because we've been given bad information, or we misremember correct information, or what have you.
Right.
But in many cases, the president has just blatantly been caught in a lie.
Right.
He has to have known that he was lying. And what they do to somehow reconcile that in their minds with this image of the man as, you know, this honest Christian,
yeah,
is they amend his statements.
Here's the problem, John.
Or reinterpret them so that they're somehow not lies.
Yeah, I suspect that it's possible that Justin Frank, the guy who wrote Bush on the Couch, the psychiatrist, is actually right that Bush doesn't know that these are lies. For example, when he was down in Florida, when 9/11 happened, on 9/11, he was down in Florida at that school. There was no newscast on any of the televisions in that school.
But he claims he saw the first plane fly into the World Trade Tower.
Well, in fact, I'm going to play the clip of it for you in just a second. You can hear it. And secondly, that first plane, the video of it hitting the tower didn't appear until the next day because it came from, I believe it was a French tourist. And because none of the news services were pointing cameras at the World Trade Center until after the first plane hit it. And then they were all pointing at it, so they all saw what we all saw was the second plane hitting. And so here's George W. Bush talking about this.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Carter, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
So, you know, now, what, did he just make that up? Yeah.
Well,
I, you know, this is called being a pathological liar.
Well, I was thinking, the example I was thinking of was, you remember, of course, that he made on two public statements, basically, that he was no longer concerned about Osama bin Laden. At press conferences, he made the statements.
Well, in fact, I've got those.
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him, really, to be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
There you go.
But then in the third debate with John Kerry, when Kerry called him on the statement, he denied ever saying it.
That's right.
So, I mean, it has to be a conscious lie unless he has short-term memory damage.
Well, that's possible. But the guy was a severe alcoholic for 30 years.
Well, but what I hear his supporters do, like I confronted a supporter with that when she was, you know, arguing that she gives him good intentions no matter what the result of his policies because, well, she believes he's a genuine Christian. He wouldn't lie. He wouldn't mislead. And I gave that statement to her, and she's like, oh, well, but what he really meant when he said he wasn't worried about Osama bin Laden was he wasn't worried that Osama bin Laden could launch more attacks on us because, you know, he's sort of contained in Pakistan. That's what he really meant. So he was telling the truth when he defended himself against John Kerry.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this president's policies should leave him with approval rating of about, I don't know, 15% to 20%.
Well,
if he didn't have a massive capacity for rationalization,
and
part of these diehard supporters,
and if he didn't have a press,
well, and a massive right-wing noise machine.
Well, it's not just that. It's that what has happened is that we no longer have news. We now have stars on TV.
Correct.
And they're paid huge six-figure, seven-figure salaries.
Chris Matthews and Russert.
That's right. And they're afraid that if they lose access to the president and to the big names in the Republican Party, which is in power right now, they will be out of business. And they will. And so they suck up to them. And it's just that simple. John, I gotta run. But thank
sure.
you. You made a great point. And so, yeah, there's a lot of enablers out there as well. But I think that this guy, I think Americans are waking up to what the deal is with George W. Bush and when he's lying to us.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Time for our Bioneers segment for the day, bioneers.org. Now, Neelam Sharma is currently Projects Director for Community Services Unlimited. This is csuinc.org, a nonprofit based in South Central Los Angeles working to address the inequalities and barriers that impede communities and self-reliance. And Neelam Sharma, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Am I mispronouncing your name? It's Neelam.
Neelam.
Neelam Sharma. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. You moved from the UK to LA. Why?
Well, actually, I moved because I met my now husband.
I see. Yeah. So the work that you're doing in LA, what got you involved in this?
What actually got me involved initially in this work was when my children started to attend LA schools. And I started to get really concerned about the fact that my son would come home every day having not eaten all day, even though he had lunch tickets. And so the first few weeks of going to school in Los Angeles, I kind of wondered what that was about. And then we talked to him about it, and he would tell me, well, you know, Mom, if you had to eat it, you wouldn't eat it. And why don't you come and check it out? So I did that one day, and I was really horrified with what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of kids, not just my son, who even had the school lunch tickets, you know, I would see them again and again, obviously very hungry, go and collect their trays, sit down to eat, and take a mouthful of everything on their tray and then just push it away and see tray after tray almost completely full in the trash cans. You know, so that's kind of what began to get me involved in this particular work that I'm doing now.
So the project that you're working on now, the work that you're doing, give us a quick overview of it.
Okay, well, we have two main projects. One is school-based, and what we're doing with that is we're creating really on-site mini urban farms at local schools in the area where we're growing fruit orchards and creating beds where we're growing a variety of vegetables, herbs, flowers, and we're doing this with students in the schools. Where we work with them in the classroom and they work with us creating and tending these garden sites. Mm-hmm. And then the produce is harvested by the students. They learn about its nutritional value. They learn about its history, its culinary use. I think the difference in the approach we've taken is that it's very culturally oriented. So we work with foods that are culturally relevant to the student population that we're working with. And then we teach these kids about their own agricultural food histories. And I think that's why we've been so effective in engaging the students that we engage in the program.
So I'm assuming that you're dealing with populations that are primarily either Hispanic or African-American or Caucasian, is that?
Where we live in South Central L.A., it's primarily overwhelmingly Mexican Central American now and African-American.
So what is cultural? I'm assuming that culturally relevant for folks from Central and South America is what we might think of as Mexican food.
Yes, correct. So, you know, what we teach them about, though, isn't just the foods that are now understood to be cultural foods, like, you know, quesadillas and tortillas and corn, but also how these foods evolved. So, you know, many of these students are completely unaware of the kind of importance that, for example, the cultivation of corn played in the history of their culture. You know, so we teach them about that, about how this food was first cultivated to be no larger than my pinky finger and just to be a wild grass, and how it was cultivated by their ancestors to become this extremely staple and important food for many cultures around the world, and how the milpa was created by their people, you know, the three sister crops of corn, beans, and squash and other vegetables that are grown in with it, and how these foods nutritionally, you know, make up almost a completely sound nutrition, how they work in the soil, how they work in the body. Yeah. And so for the African-American population, for example, we would work with foods like yams, like black-eyed peas, that are foods that were known to have been brought here by slaves on slave ships.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. So, by the way, I'm curious, when you talk about corn with kids from Central and South America, do you have an opportunity to talk to them about how corn farmers and subsistence farmers across Central and South America are being wiped out and driven off their land by the agricultural subsidies to corn growers in the United States and exports of corn from the United States to South America?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And nobody, no right-winger has come down on you and said, what, you're teaching politics in school?
No, because of the way we teach it. So, for example, we're really excited right now. We just finished doing some work with another nonprofit from Northern California, and we were really lucky in that they had with them the last couple of weeks a sister from Chiapas who works with the Zapatistas, and she had brought with her some heirloom blue corn seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a huge planting with all the students in our schools of blue corn. And so one of the projects that we're working with the students on now is using Mendel's system of making sure that the corn does not get contaminated and, you know, kind of saving these seeds and using that as a concrete way of teaching them about the, you know, the way that the genetic integrity of corn has been attacked and, you know, and the impact that this is having on cultures. So that's kind of the way we do it. We do it in a very concrete way.
Mm-hmm. That's remarkable. That's remarkable. And what sort of what's the consequence of this? What result are you seeing?
Sorry?
What result are you seeing?
Well, what we're seeing is that we're seeing students who, almost without exception, at the beginning when they start their sessions with us, they go from being almost embarrassed about talking about cultural foods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they only want to talk, particularly the newer immigrants from Mexico, Central America, you know, they don't want to talk about their cultural foods. They don't want to talk about rice and beans and corn and tortillas. You know, they want to only talk about hamburgers and fries. And
right.
Literally. And then we see as they learn about what these foods have meant to their culture, as they learn about how important these foods have been worldwide, you know, and then as they start to actually work with the earth and plant the seeds and see the foods grow and harvest what they've grown and in some cases grind it into flour and use it and then make recipes with it in the classroom, we just see a complete change in attitude, you know, where they, obviously they're still eating junk food, they're kids, but there's certainly an openness to healthy foods. There's an openness to, you know, their own cultural foods and seeing them as having value, you know, that they're not only now just kind of wanting to get, you know, the foods that they see around them advertised constantly, but they actually do see that these foods, oh, they really do have a value, both historically, agriculturally, and nutritionally.
Mm-hmm. That's marvelous. That's absolutely marvelous. Neelam Sharma, if people wanted to learn more about it, I'm assuming CSUINC is the website for the Community Services Unlimited?
CSUINC.org, yeah.
INC.org. And they can find out more information about that there.
Sure. And, yeah, contact us. There's email addresses at the website. They can contact us directly.
Great.
Thank
you so much. Neelam Sharma, of the community, the Projects Director for Community Services Unlimited. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Great speaking with you. Bye now. It's a remarkable story, absolutely remarkable story. By the way, Russia and China, this I have to get this in here before the break. This Security Council, this from the Associated Press, Nick Wadhams reports, Russia and China have rejected proposals from the United States and other veto-wielding members of the United Nations Security Council for a statement demanding that Iran clear up suspicions about its nuclear program, diplomats said Monday. Again, keep in mind, Iran is not in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They are not in violation of any treaties. They're not in violation of any laws. They're not in violation of any international... They are, however, behaving in a way that many people in the international community consider suspicious. And but, you know, we're sending these very strange messages. We go over to India, who refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. In other words, in terms of their nuclear behavior, was a rogue state. And say, well, you know, now that a few million American jobs are here in India, and all these companies are opening factories here in India, and all these, you know, call centers are here in India, and all this guy, I guess that we'll just let you have your nuclear weapons, you know, whatever you want. And Pakistan, run by a military dictator, yeah, that's okay. That's a fine thing. We're not going to fight with you about that. But Iran says, that, well, you know, actually, it was the United States who built our nuclear reactors. You guys, you know, when the Shah was in power, you sold us this nuclear stuff. You know, if GE made a fortune on it, or Bechtel, or whoever it was, don't you want us to continue? No, we'd rather you didn't. Very strange. Expect John Bolton to get in on this any day now. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about, but we're going to talk about this stuff anyway. For example, yes, our conservative alert for the day. Actually, our Homeland Security alert for the day. Last week, we told you about a retired Texas school teacher who paid off a $6,520 credit card debt in order to avoid all the interest payments, and found that their account had been frozen by the Department of Homeland Security. And we thought, you know, or I thought at the time, well, maybe it's just because it was over $5,000, because there are those laws, those banking laws, that go back to the attempts to interdict drug dealers. Frankly, some folks think that it's got nothing to do with that, that it's just Big Brother coming full tilt boogie, and I'm not going to disagree with that. But in any case, that used to say that if you did more than $10,000 in cash business with a bank, it had to be reported to the FBI or somebody. No, it had to be reported to the IRS, that they were looking for people who were laundering money. And then it became $5,000. And my understanding is that that's where it's at, $5,000 in cash, but I may be wrong. In any case, now we have a new one. This Walter Sonhage was the guy who had paid off his big credit card. Now we have a new one. This is Edie Booth. She's a community college professor in East Texas, and she made a $3,500 payment from her own account to pay down her credit card to avoid a $140 interest payment. And in order to finally pay the thing down, she borrowed $650 from her sister and had her sister wire transfer it in to pay her credit card bill. So $3,500 from her, $650 from her sister. She says, and I quote, she says, I watched the status of these two payments online since I'm not the trusting type, either when it comes to banks, credit card companies, or government. The $650 was pending one day, then showed funded the next. All seemed fine. However, I continued to check the status online for the next 5 days. On the sixth day, I found the extra $650 payment canceled. Upon calling the credit card company, guess who canceled it? If you guess the Department of Homeland Security, you win the prize. She was then slapped with a $140 charge from her credit card company since the $650 payment didn't clear, and it didn't clear because the Homeland Security Department nailed it. So, yeah, guys with box cutters getting on airplanes, couldn't stop that. Community college teachers in East Texas paying off credit cards, we're on it. Right on it. No problem. Steve in Albany. Hey, Steve, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, this is Steve Wickham. And I've called because you just played a clip a while ago of the president saying he saw the video of
right.
the first plane.
Right, which is impossible.
World Trade Center. Impossible, exactly. And you made the case that that was proof that he's a pathological liar.
Or at least a very comfortable liar.
Or a very comfortable liar.
Yeah.
There's the other possibility that he actually knew that the plane was going to be hitting, and that confused him.
Well, it's possible, although, you know, he told the whole story of actually watching it on TV, and I have had people who are of the opinion that Bush was behind 9/11 say to me, well, I think he did watch it on TV. I think they all stood there, and they said, okay, it's going to happen, let's watch, and then it happened, and then they went into the classroom. I just don't, you know, even if Bush had advanced knowledge of it, which is pretty obvious now. He had advanced knowledge that something like this was going to happen. I mean, over 50 presidential briefings telling him that they were going to hijack planes, that they were scoping out buildings in New York and Washington, D.C., that it was going to happen sometime in August or September, that, you know, and he therefore took the longest presidential vacation in the history of the presidency, stayed down in Crawford an extra couple of weeks, and then finally, then still wouldn't go back to Washington, D.C., went to Florida instead. And, you know, in spite of all that, I just can't get my mind around the idea of him and Andy Card and a bunch of his aides and Secret Service details sitting around watching a closed circuit TV of, oh boy, let's watch the planes hit the towers. I can't imagine it.
I don't think that they watched the closed circuit TV either. I think that they were aware that this actually happened. I recently watched a movie called Loose Change 9/11,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know if you've seen or not. It's a great documentary. It puts Fahrenheit 9/11 to shame.
Mm-hmm.
And people can watch it online for free on Google.
Uh-huh.
But I've never been of the conspiracy mindset, but this particular documentary, which I learned about from Mike Malloy on, mm-hmm. on his show, really opened my eyes, and I really believe that because every decision that people seem to make politically and economically revolves around what happened on 9/11, that we as a society need to know exactly what did happen, because there are two conspiracy theories here.
There's about a dozen conspiracy theories here.
I'm basically saying, though, that there's the official one, which you just referred to a few moments ago, with guys with box cutters getting on and flying two planes into, you know, the World Trade Center,
right,
and causing the first three buildings in history to collapse due to fire of
right.
that nature, you know,
yeah.
skyscrapers, causing two more planes on the same day to completely disintegrate and disappear, first time again in history. Those are the kinds of things that I wasn't aware of, and it just seems that there's more to what happened on 9/11 than 18 guys.
I don't disagree with you, Steve. I think that there's a lot more to it than just 18 guys getting on airplanes. But I'm not sure that I'm not ready to go to the airplanes were remote controlled or Bush or the government had anything to do with it necessarily. But yes, I absolutely agree with you that we don't know the whole story and we should. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Boy, some just absolutely amazing statistics here. Welcome back, by the way. 25 minutes, coming up on 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you. The percentage of Americans who believe that George Bush decided to go to war to free the Iraqis or promote democracy, according to a new CBS poll. What percentage of Americans do you think believe that George Bush actually went to war in Iraq for the reason that he gave after his first reason fell apart? His first reason was weapons of mass destruction. That didn't turn out. So then he said, no, we had another reason. There was another reason why we went as well. This is a new reason, but it's also the old reason. It's just as good. We're going to free the Iraqis. We're going to promote democracy. We're going to save them from that nasty Saddam. What percentage of Americans believe that? Now, let me first tell you that over a third of Americans believe in flying saucers, believe that flying saucers have visited Earth. Over a quarter of Americans will tell you that they have seen an angel or some supernatural phenomena. But the percentage of Americans who believe that George Bush decided to go to war to free the Iraqis or promote democracy, 3%. The percentage of Americans who believe the Iraq war was worth the costs, 25%. That's fewer Americans believe the Iraq war was worth the cost than believe that we have been visited by space aliens in the recent past. Now, I'm not unwilling to say that we've been visited by space aliens. I don't mean to put down those folks. I'm just saying, you know, it's like faith is belief in those things unseen, perhaps. More Downing Street revelations coming out, a confidential memo written in May of 2003, this from Think Progress. John Sowers, the Prime Minister Tony Blair's envoy in Baghdad, characterized the U.S. post-war administration of Iraq. Now, keep in mind, this was at exactly the time This is exactly the time that Bush was saying,
my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Okay, at the same time that Bush was saying that, Prime Minister Tony Blair's envoy in Baghdad, John Sawyers, wrote back to London that the U.S. post-war administration of Iraq has, quote, no leadership, no strategy, no coordination, no structure, and is inaccessible to ordinary Iraqis. By the way, when the 9/11 Inquiry Commission report was done, Pakistan's Foreign Office paid tens of thousands of dollars to lobbyists in the United States to get anti-Pakistan references dropped from the commission report, according to Foreign Service officials in a Pakistani weekly newspaper. It's getting stranger and stranger. Pat Robertson tossing more hate bombs. He called Muslims satanic and says Bush is wrong when he says Islam is a religion of peace. And Jerry Falwell, of course, same day. These guys, Jerry Falwell saying it's impossible for a Jew to go to heaven. Unless, of course, they've been converted to Christianity. Some of these alliances, I think, are going to start breaking down. I wonder what Joe Lieberman has to say about that. Because these guys have been, well, in bed with each other for a long, long time. And it's time for people to figure out that the right-wing Christians are not about Christianity. They're about power. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click the live chat button. Ralph in Northampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Ralph, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Ralph. How about you?
Good. Same with me.
Good.
Hey, I want to agree with your last caller who talked about that DVD, A Call to Reopen, September 11 investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrific, and you can get it for nothing.
Yeah, on Google's Movies?
Yeah, I think so, but I got it. I ordered it.
Yeah, I have at least five, maybe six DVDs or videotapes of, you know, what happened in 9/11.
This is the best one.
There's just a whole bunch of them out there.
But this
and,
is the best one.
Yeah, and for
I
me...
I got a bunch, too, because I've written about this for my elderly group.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a couple of questions that seem not to be answered about September 11th that are pretty well answered on that. And that number one, and before I got that DVD, I had written about my feelings about it. And I asked the question, where was the plane that hit the Pentagon?
Yeah.
No one's ever seen a plane, and it's...
Well, actually, you know, there were hundreds of witnesses driving on the highway that day who saw the plane go over the top of them. It's just that for most of the conspiracy films that I've seen, they don't bother reporting that fact.
Who saw what?
Who saw a plane fly right over the top of them and hit the Pentagon.
Well, if there was a plane that hit the Pentagon, and you look at the hole that it made, it would have stuck out.
Perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't know. The Pentagon's never been hit by a plane before.
Yeah, I know.
And the Pentagon is built out of stuff that is not what an ordinary building would be built out of, I'm assuming.
Right.
But it
couldn't have collapsed in there. What size plane?
We've got to beep that out, and I appreciate the call, Ralph. Thank you. Thank you for dumping it. I appreciate it. It's just it had nothing to do with my disagreeing with Ralph. It had to do with his using language you can't say on the air. Hey, Howard, welcome. Well, Howard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, welcome to the program.
Yes. Yesterday, I'm trying to see if I heard you correctly or not, because I couldn't find anything on the Internet about this. It seems like, well, correct me if I'm wrong, that you mentioned something about a Congressman DeWine.
Right. Mike DeWine of Ohio is preparing. It has not been introduced.
Oh, it hasn't been introduced.
He's preparing legislation. He has several co-sponsors. One of them I know is Olympia Snow. I don't recall who the other co-sponsors are. Oh, Biden was one of them.
I thought Hagel.
And Hagel, that's right. Biden, Hagel, yeah.
And Biden?
I believe, well, I may be wrong on that. But I don't think so. I think that those are the four senators, two Democrats and two Republicans. And the legislation would basically make it a crime for anyone to possess or reveal information about the Bush administration breaking the law. And now, when it was pointed out to DeWine, that the way his legislation was written, it would mean that any journalist could go to jail. His statement to the press was, well, that wasn't our intent. We weren't trying to stifle the media. But he didn't say, and therefore we're going to change this legislation. So we're just going to have to wait and see what comes out. It's supposed to be released in the next week.
Really? Okay, one thing I'll say, and then I'll...
And by the way, forget the press. This would criminalize... I mean, don't forget the press, but I mean, setting aside issues of the press. This would criminalize the behavior of bloggers. This would criminalize the behavior of independent researchers. Like, you know, our caller just a minute ago in Massachusetts was talking about, I think that the 9/11 mysteries are going to be solved the same way the JFK mysteries are, which is by 10, 20, 30, 40 years of hundreds of people doing independent investigations.
Yeah.
And this would criminalize that.
Can you imagine
if they passed a law that said that if you hold information about the Kennedy assassination that isn't known to the public, that you can go to prison? I mean, that's essentially what they're saying. If you have information about what the Bush administration is doing that might be against the law, you can go to jail.
Yeah.
Or be hit by 15 years in prison or $1 million fine or both.
Yeah. Can I say one more thing and I'll let you go?
Sure.
I don't understand why the Democrats don't use class warfare more. I think the Republicans use class warfare against us, and I don't understand why the Democrats don't respond with class warfare. And what I mean by this is that we should speak out more on the minimum wage and the tax cuts for the rich. And
I agree.
What I think is they should don't be asking for maybe $1 an hour on the minimum wage. Go for $2 or $3. Why don't we wage class warfare?
Yeah, let's take the minimum wage to $10 or $12 an hour.
Yes.
That's really what it costs to live in America these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't disagree with you at all, Howard. You know, the only Democrat that I know of who did that was John Edwards.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he wasn't calling for a $12 minimum wage, but he was talking about the two Americas. That was his, and continues to, by the way. And he's out there working with poverty groups all across the United States. And that's why I keep coming back to John Edwards. I think, you know, John Edwards, Al Gore, and Russ Feingold, and Howard Dean are at the top of my list for 2008.
Yeah.
And the media, of course, doesn't want any of them because all of them, in my opinion, are people who there's a possibility that they would go back to enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and breaking up the big media monopolies. In fact, as I've said before on this program, I remember the day. There was the week that Howard Dean was on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and everybody was saying, Howard Dean is unstoppable. He's going to be the Democratic candidate. And go, man, go. And it was a phenomenon, and everybody was loving it. And, you know, this is going to be great. And my wife Louise and I were sitting at home watching Howard Dean being interviewed by Chris Matthews, and Matthews said, what are you going to do about the big media monopolies? And Dean said, if I'm elected president, I'm going to break them up. And Matthews had this look on his face like Dean had just farted out loud or something. He said, made some unmentionable noise or something. He says, you're kidding. And Dean was like, no. And he says, you mean like this company, which is owned by General Electric, you would make them divest MSNBC and run it independently? And Dean said, yes, I think media companies should be, now I'm paraphrasing, this is not from perfect memory or anything, but Dean said, I think that media companies should be media companies, and they shouldn't be owned by defense contractors or other companies. They should stand alone as media companies, and they shouldn't be monopolies. They should be competing with each other. And Chris Matthews was just aghast, absolutely aghast. And I turned to Louise and I said, this is the end of the road for Howard Dean's candidacy. I said, that's it. He has now turned the media against him. And I kid you not, Howard, we were looking for this. I was talking about it on the radio. In fact, I talked about it on this program the next day. The next day, right across the board, NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, NBC, MSNBC, all of them, all of a sudden started talking about Howard Dean. Is he stable or unstable? Is he a little cranky? Is he a little weird? Can he make it? Can he not make it? Raising questions about him and making it seem like Howard Dean was like, you know, the crackpot du jour. And that's what did it. So you got to be careful. And maybe DeWine will run afoul of the media. Who knows with this, you know, that's what you called about. But anyhow, my thing is, I suspect since Hillary's husband signed the Telecommunications Act of 96, which made the situation so bad, that she wouldn't break it up. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now there's people living out in the street, going hungry with no shoes on their feet, while the government
thumbs and spend more money on guns. And they keep on planning nuclear war. Tell me, who is it they're planning it for? If not the men that make their profits from hate, I swear it seems they can't wait. This is what democracy means. This is what democracy means.
And welcome back, my friends. Nah, this is not what democracy means. Democracy's coming back. It's coming back, my friends. Welcome back to the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program, 9 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, 440-THOM. And Barry in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Barry, what's on your mind today?
Mr. Hartman.
Indeed, that's me.
Yeah, I'm talking to you, okay, right now. Well, first of all, I heard the president of Iran speak through a translator about the hypocrisy of the West in that they have nuclear power. They won't let other people have that. And
yes.
Then also the book by Stephen Kinzer, All the Shah's Men, how the British Empire just took everything of value from Iran, and Iran gave so much of power to the world, and we're not allowing them to have that for themselves.
Sure.
The book by Stephen Kinzer, All the Shah's Men.
Well, the problem and the problem is right now that we don't approve of their politics. We don't approve of their, you know, of their saber rattling and actually, you know, there could be even a larger issue, because ironically, Iran right now is a democracy. I mean, everybody in the Iranian government was actually democratically elected. They actually held elections.
Yep.
But I saw a statistic the other day, Barry, where,
yep.
Remember Dick Cheney back 3 years ago, just before the invasion of Iraq, had this to say.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Well, it turns out now they've recalculated, and the country that is the second in the world to Saudi Arabia is not Iraq, it's Iran.
Oh.
So maybe Cheney and Bush had just been working on a document that had a typo on it all this time, and they attacked the wrong country. I don't know. Barry, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Could I add something else?
Sure.
Yeah, just very quickly, that I called about was Claude Allen, how this could happen in our government.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, welcome to the wonderful world of human nature, Barry.
Whoa.
I really think that, you know, humans have weaknesses, and Claude Allen obviously, you know, this was not, I don't think, something he did for money. I think this was, what he did was he went to Target stores and other stores, other retailers, went in and bought something, took it out, put it in his car, then went back in with the receipt, went to the shelf, picked up the exact same thing, and returned it to get a refund. And so now he's got the money, and he's got the receipt. Claude Allen was the number one domestic policy advisor to George W. Bush. He was the number two guy under George W. Bush for determining what the policy, domestic policy in the United States should be. And he got busted for you know, being a little weird. So, you know, it happens.
But that's like petty theft. And
it is.
No organization or business would hire those kind of people.
What well, that's why Claude Allen got bounced out of the White House. That's why they're referring to him now as the domestic policy advisor, because they figured out this was going on. They just were hoping the press wouldn't figure it out. Barry, I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Jane in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jane, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First-time caller. Thank you for all that you do.
Thank you.
I was just calling to tell you about a press conference that was held this morning in Pittsburgh. It was from the Thomas Merton Center for Peace and Justice and the ACLU.
Mm-hmm.
They held a press conference to announce that they had obtained documents that prove conclusively that this organization, their anti-war group specifically, was being targeted for their opposition to the war.
Right.
In
other words, the FBI was spying on them?
Yes, the counterterrorism unit of the FBI was spying on them.
Yeah.
And all these people were doing, basically they identify themselves as pacifists. They stand on corners, they hand out flyers and leaflets. These people have been standing on corners since the war began.
Yeah.
And
Jane, I have seen this movie before. In the late 60s and early 70s, my wife and I were very active in the anti-war movement. We were, I was I don't know if you could call it a member, because nobody ever came up to me and said, sign this membership card, but I was there at all the SDS rallies. I was part of, you know, Students for Democratic Society. And I remember there was this one guy in particular who all the time was saying, we need to go out and firebomb a building, we need to do this, that, the other thing. He was always, you know, advocating violence. A couple of years later, in the mid-70s or so, I was, you know, we had kind of all moved on and I was running a business, but I was still living in Michigan. And a couple of friends of mine, actually one of the guys who was the titular head of SDS, sued the Michigan State Police and the FBI to get his records, and he got all of our records. I mean, and just boxes and boxes of this stuff. And the interesting thing that we discovered was that this guy who was always saying we got to go bomb a building was actually working for the local. I don't recall if he was working for the FBI or for the state police, but one or the other. And it was just, I mean, I've seen this movie before. It's just, and it's sad that we're seeing it again, because that was during the Nixon years, you know. And
you know, Tom, it is very sad, because most of the people in this organization are middle-aged or older, and they are simply supported by the students in the Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and we were just kids, and we were supported, yeah, actually by the middle-aged and older folks at the local Methodist church, where they used to let us hold our meetings. So,
it's
Jane,
sad.
I appreciate your call. I'm sorry we're out of time, but it's a shame, and thank you for sharing that with the reality that with all of our listeners. Coming up in the next Tom Hartman program, I'll be debating conservative David Theobald about how much longer will the conservatives have the fantasy of a liberal media. Jeffrey Feldman will be here with us too, from Frame Shop is Open. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.